Welcome to the Just Fly Sports Performance Podcast, Episode 1. Today, I'm talking with Scott Sawasser, Director of Speed and Power Development at Texas Tech University. So I'm here with Scott Sawasser. In addition to his current role at Texas Tech, he was the lead football assistant at the University of California, Berkeley for strength and conditioning. There, he worked with some number one combine event performers, had some great success, and in the 2016 NFL Combine, he worked with the number one performing vertical jump and broad jump athletes, and had some other amazing performances in the top three. Something I definitely think about Scott is that he's kind of a track coach for football in his current role. You know, when we were working together, I always saw loads of material on speed training information on his desk, very well read, and he knows speed. And I'm excited to have him on the show today.
So, Scott, let's get started. And with the first question here, and in a nutshell, 5-10 minutes or less, your philosophy on training speed in football players.
Right, Joel. Well, first of all, thank you for having me on. I really enjoy Just Fly Sports, and you know, it's really an asset to our program. And you know, anytime I think of something that I want to know a little bit more about, like, for instance, I called you about the depth jump versus the drop jump, so forth and so on. You know, you guys are a great, you specifically are an excellent asset for that. So thank you for all that you do for the profession in that regard.
Thanks, man. I appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem, man. So in terms of philosophy for training speed, I think the first thing, and this is what I tell recruits too when they come on their visit, is that everything we do develop speed. And I think that's important for people to understand. It's not just these drills or those drills or this or that. It's everything. You know, it's the lifting, it's the mobility, it's, you know, the warm up, it's the energy systems development, obviously it's the speed work, it's the jumping, it's literally everything we do contributes to our speed development. And I think that's important for people to understand. And it's really important for my players to understand, because it allows me to reach guys a lot better. My specific groups that I work with comprehensively are skill position players, DBs, receivers, running backs, so forth and so on. And of course, speed is probably their number one ability that they need to be able to demonstrate to be effective on the field. And the more I can tie everything we do into speed, obviously the better buy-in I get from them, you know, because there's some things that they look at and they're like, why am I doing this? Well, I'll tell you why, you know, because this helps you with this aspect of moving better, moving faster. So very comprehensive approach. Everything, like I said, everything we do contributes to our speed development.
Awesome. So it's like a total, like, holistic, you know, holistic approach, integral approach.
Completely. Yeah.
Tell me actually a little bit more, and our listeners, just a little bit more about exactly what you do and how you work with the football team. Because I think your position is, you know, it's a great, unique position, but very relevant.
Right.
And so, yeah, explain a little bit about that.
So I'm specifically in charge of the linear speed development program for the entire football team. And I'm also in charge of the plyometric program for the entire football team. Now, obviously, there's different needs for different positions. And so, you know, it's not just a cookie cutter system. I've got to try to meet the speed development demands of not only different positions, but also different individuals, because everybody needs. I'm not saying I run 100 different programs, but, you know, everybody's got different needs in terms of what they need to get faster. And then in addition to the speed and the plyos, I specifically am in charge of the strength, comprehensive strength program for, as I mentioned, offensive and defensive skill guys, the fast guys, so to speak. So,
awesome. Could you chat maybe a little bit about how within your the strength program you run for those skill guys, you know, does that and how does it differ from, you know, how you'd run strength for the linemen? And can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, certainly, you know, the primary needs of a lineman are going to be further to the left of the force velocity curve. They're going to be working against resistance the entire time, and obviously shorter distances, different demands, you know, than a skill guy. A skill guy is going to be obviously farther to the right, higher velocities, more mileage, so to speak, higher speed changes of direction, so forth and so on. So we really try to mirror that, not so much in a bunch of different things coming out of left field, but for me, the easiest way is just the volume and where you spread around your emphasis. So for example, the big guys' volume of jumping is a lot less than the speed guys, you know, and the progression is similar in terms of exercise selection. Obviously, we'll work up to a higher intensity, higher end, so to speak, plyos with the skill guys, but you know, with the skill guys, we'll jump more. Obviously, the speed volumes will be higher. Conditioning volumes or energy system development volumes will be higher. You know, and then in the weight room, again, depends kind of on the person. So, you know, in general, I would say that with skill guys, I spend more time trying to move things at a higher velocity. You know, working reactive strength, working speed strength, so forth and so on. But as I mentioned, everyone's different. So if I've got a guy that clearly doesn't have the maximal strength to be effective in the first place, I'm not going to get cute with them. You know, I'm going to get him under some load. So we have a number of guys like that, you know, that just don't have, first of all, the hypertrophy that they may need. Second of all, the maximal strength levels to really benefit from that higher rate of force development work. So we've got to start out just by, hey, you know, let's get them strong first, you know, and that's kind of where a multi-level system comes in. You know, your younger guys, your underdeveloped guys, you don't really need to get too cute with them. You know, they've got to have a certain level of strength, maximal strength to begin with, to really benefit from some of the other stuff. Now, if I've got some veteran guys, you know, that already have a good base of strength, like at Cal specifically, we had some senior receivers last year. One I can think of in particular, you know, he's 180 something pounds and he's back squatting 455, you know, below parallel fast enough that when he comes out of the hole, the bar almost flies off his shoulders. Well, he doesn't need to get any stronger than that, you know, and I don't necessarily have a number in mind like, okay, once they reach this limit, you can just tell, you know, and the guy I talked about was excellent out of, you know, excellent in his start, early acceleration, you couldn't beat him. So, you know, okay, we're going to focus on other things. We're going to focus on, maybe we're focusing on more single leg unilateral work, you know, maybe we're focusing on more posterior chain work or so forth and so on. But I'm a fan of obviously of position specific, but also really if I can meet the individual needs of an athlete, I'm going to try to do that as well within the aspect of obviously I've got a large group, so it's got to fit within that realm as well. You can't have so many things going on that you can't watch it or can't monitor it or can't coach it. So.
Yeah, that's a great mindset. I like how you talk about just keeping it simple, but then, you know, just drawing those black and white distinctions. Skill guys, a little more reactive, a little more single leg, you know, a little more related to top end speed versus first few steps. And I think that's really cool stuff. You know, something I'm interested in too, along those lines, is, you know, you talk about the guy who's got the huge back squat, you know, that 450 is just coming up, like, and it's not stopping. And then you're moving that person more towards some posterior chain control just working balance. I know you're really good at that. You know, probably one of your specialties. Could you go into a little bit more maybe of, you know, if how you can tell if you're going to how do you balance out a football player, you know, through your assessment procedures in that regard?
Right. Well, initially at Cal, it started out with force plate testing. We had the luxury of having a force plate there, and it really started because we all know that there's certain strength qualities that are associated with different parts of speed, from the first three steps to transition to top end speed. there's different strength qualities associated with each of those. Now, my question was, can we make the connection so thoroughly that we don't need to run a guy over 40 yards, that if I can just have him do a vertical jump and I can get his force time curve, which obviously I understand you need a force plate to do, but if I can just get his force time curve, can I already know what I need to work on him with maybe early off season or, you know, winter when we have high volumes in the weight room. We're not running guys 40 yards, you know, we're working start early excel, sled work, hill work, so forth and so on. But I already know what he's going to look like over 40 yards because I have his force time curve. So I can already begin working towards that without having to run 40, obviously check his splits and figure out what he needs from there. Now here, I don't necessarily have a force plate, but I think a lot of it comes with just the coach's eye of having seen enough guys run, see how they move again comprehensively across the board. You know, if we're doing reactive plyos and a guy lands in mud, you know, I can already envision, you know, probably what he's going to need to work on potentially in speed work, you know, or you get your guys, you know, that are, you know, reactive jumping tests, like, you know, triple broad jump or something, you know, his single broad jump is great. And then two and three aren't what you would like. Well, you know, that guy, you know, potentially he could have a great start, and then as he gets going, you know, hit a rut kind of. So I mean, there's other ways. And then as I mentioned, in the weight room, you know who's explosive, who's strong, you know, your big meathead weight room guys, they're gonna be good early on in the 40, just because I mean, we've seen it enough. You know, people a lot smarter than me have proven that there's a high correlation between just maximal strength and early sprint speed, you know. So I know that the trickier part is as you get further on in the 40, when the weight room stuff starts to wear off and there's more other factors going on, such as relaxation, obviously skill, reactive strength, you know, good stiffness, so forth and so on. That's where it gets to be more and more tricky. But the early stuff, you know, I know that my guys that can clean 315, you know, they're going to be jumping out of their stance more than likely.
Yeah, definitely. Cool. That's great stuff. And, you know, along those lines too, and I guess leading into another question I wanted to ask you, you know, working with football players for speed, it's probably a little bit different than working with, you know, 160 pound track athlete for speed. Like, these guys probably have things that you find yourself cueing more often than what maybe a track coach might see. What are some things that you typically have to work with your football players, especially in that 20 to 40 yard, you know, split right range?
So typically, I would say in general, football players are going to have a pretty big engine. Like we talked about with the strength qualities and stuff, they're typically going to have a pretty big engine. And by that high power output, they're usually going to be strong enough and powerful enough to get into the positions that you want them to get into. But the trick with them is, when you talk specifically about 20 to 40, is relaxation. Because most of these guys want to muscle the entire race because that's what they're used to doing. And also, I noticed that's really when some of your mobility, stability, kind of structural positioning issues start to come into play. You know, so your guys that are big-time anterior tilt guys, that's when the back starts to arch. That's when the butt starts to stick out, you know, and then obviously everything – there's an equal and opposite reaction. Now the foot starts to cast and off you go, you know, and you see it even more really than just speed work, because they're going to be pretty fresh because you're going to give them the optimal amount of rest. But when you start talking energy system development, that's when you really see it. Guys, compensations coming to the forefront. But I would say for that backside, again, pretty powerful football players, tough time relaxing and really making sure that they have the necessary functional mobility and stability to get into that sprint position. You know, a lot of the guys, starting with the pelvis, it's tough for them to even put their pelvis in a relatively neutral position just standing there, let alone moving at 20 plus miles an hour. You know, so that's one thing that I really try to work on initially when you talk about assessing and stuff is, okay, can this guy even get into sprint position to begin with? You know, if he can't standing up, well, can he laying on the ground? You know, and that may sound very rudimentary and basic, but these guys at this level are master compensators. You know, they'll run, a good 40 looking like crap and inefficient as all get out, you know, just because, again, they have the horsepower and they can compensate and find a way. But I want to start out at the most basic level. Okay, you know, can he get into the positions? Once he can get into the positions, you know, can he pattern correctly at a slow speed and then at a faster speed? And it's only going to help them, you know, and again, as much speed as also energy system development, because inefficiencies are what kill these guys. You know, like I tell them all the time, you want to have an easier time during conditioning, get faster. And you know, it sounds, you know, overly simple, but I'm a big believer, you know, in movement efficiency and also speed reserve. You know, the faster I can get them, the easier everything else is going to be, because they're already capable of moving at a speed that's beyond sufficient for what they're trying to do. So I forgot where that question even started.
Oh, no, that was good. I was just chatting with a little bit about, I think the question was, how do you address the 20 to 40 speed? But that's awesome. Because it's the 20 to 40, it's the max speed is the great equalizer, you know, with compensations. You can cheat your way through 5 yards, you know, but it's that point where it all starts coming out, and then the conditioning probably just exacerbates it. I'm sure you've seen, I'm sure you've seen a lot of gnarly running during.
I got two analogies for what guys look like sometimes during conditioning. One is, if you guys have ever seen that lizard that goes across the hot sand, and he kind of shuffles and he's externally rotated and he goes side to side. And then the old time cartoons where it'd be like Looney Tunes, and there'd be a tornado and an arm would pop out and then a head would pop out. That's what some of these guys look like sometimes. So yeah, you gotta correct that.
Yeah, that's funny. I believe it. Cool. So moving on, you know, we talked a little about speed here. Tell me a little bit about what you're doing with plyometrics. You know, what types of – and I really like, too, by the way, your the broad jump and measuring the first broad jump versus the last few. I feel like that could be almost a simpler way of trying to do what you're doing in the 40 sometimes, right? Maybe if you didn't have the time to set up. That I hadn't thought about that. That's really cool.
That and obviously, which is not new, but counter movement jump versus non-counter movement jump. I really, after our talk, I've tried to get to the point where I feel comfortable screening guys with just a basic depth jump and see, you know, how guys can jump on a depth jump. I just haven't got guys technically sound enough on it yet to really trust it as an assessment, but it's definitely going to be part of our program. What we do plyo-wise, I always try to initially get the plyos to transfer almost as kind of a special strength exercise to our movement skills, you know? So when we're early in the off season, because again, the comprehensive thing is so important. Everything's got to fit together. So, you know, I don't necessarily, while I do follow like a plyo progression, you could say it really kind of falls into place on its own by just having everything transfer to what you're doing with your speed work. So if we're working start, you know, first three steps, first 10 steps or whatever, you know, you're going to be doing broad jumps. You're going to be doing, you know, horizontal plyometrics and stuff that maybe you spend a little bit more time on the ground with, which is what you would probably do early on anyway, teaching guys how to land, you know, teaching guys how to project their bodies. And then as we start to get on in the year and some of the weight room volume starts to come down, our speed volume will pick up, And then we'll start to do some of the more reactive stuff. The article you had on the continuous hurdle hopping was fantastic. That's literally one of my favorite plyos for speed development. We'll do that, and we'll do that on one leg with obviously shorter hurdles as well, hopping. And we'll start to work towards that, shorter ground contact times, stiffer, more upright posture, more of a horizontal vertical emphasis, rather than just pure horizontal. And, a lot of what it depends on too is what you're going to test. If we're going to test this year, we didn't test, as a team, test vertical jump. So we didn't do as many vertical plyos, because I was trying to get them faster, and I felt the horizontal stuff would transfer more to what we were trying to do. Now in the summer, when we get to more of our upright speed work, you're flying 10s, you're flying 20s, we'll do more vertical work anyway, just because of obviously the vector needs of the force application. But now, had we tested vertical, obviously we would have to jump vertically more, because we're getting ready for that test. And it all depends on on, again, what you're testing and what the coach you work for really wants to prioritize. If you've got a guy that is hell-bent on the weight room, then obviously I've got to account for that with everything else. Because if and I've had football coaches before where I want everybody squatting this much and cleaning this much and benching this much. Well, if we're going to be devoting that much energy to that because that's what the sport coach wants – obviously it's got to come, it's got to give somewhere. Everybody can't be, everybody can't be so hung up on the perfect Excel spreadsheet program that they drew up. Training is so much more organic than that. It evolves and from day to day and week to week, and you have to kind of adjust as you go. Obviously you've got a plan and a template, but be humble enough to say, okay, this isn't working quite how I envisioned it. Like for instance, this winter I had a great idea. I wanted to start, I wanted to do some weighted jumping. I felt like it would fit in well with what we were doing, speed wise. We would do some weighted seated box jumps and stuff like that. And they worked all right. They just didn't work, for whatever reason. I didn't get the results I wanted to see out of them. So, I have to say, okay, the good idea fairy came to me that's nothing against that exercise. It's a great exercise, but that's my example being, okay, maybe next year I have to reevaluate that. And maybe there's something else that will give us a better bang for our buck.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a great mentality. It's like you got to have a plan B. Plan A isn't always going to work, and you have to, what you do has to fit within the philosophy of what your head coach wants to see too. I think that's really good, insightful stuff. In a perfect world, what would you test for skill players, football? What would some of the big tests you would do if it was all you? No external.
The different jumping abilities, non-counter movement, counter movement, and then depth jump as well. So static start, reactive start, but self-directed kind of, and then a true reflexive jump. I think that would be able to, that right there would be able to tell you a lot about how the guy is going to look when you get him into a sprint. I would test the 40. Obviously I'm biased, but I would test the 40 and not so that, I can tell everyone I had X amount of 4.4s or whatever. And not because I necessarily think that it's, a differentiator between good and bad football players, but I just think that the 40 yard dash for a skill guy illustrates just about almost every strength quality that you would want to see from them. The start, the static start and the first three steps are going to tell you one thing. The next, steps 4 through 11 or so are going to tell you something else. And then when they get upright, it's going to tell you a whole host of other factors, and obviously I understand that there's the skill component, which you could never discount. But since I'm their coach, I know that their skill the skill piece is going to be at least decent. It may not be perfect, but it'll be at least decent. I think just from running that race, I would be able to identify all the different strength qualities that, that I need to get them better at. As a skill player, even eccentric strength, you know, do they have the stiffness at ground contact? If that's going to transfer to other things, other athletic movements that they're going to have to do, from change of direction to decelerating, so forth and so on. The other stuff that they're going to do is really just going to be an offshoot of the qualities that you saw in linear speed. So I think that just a simple test like that can tell you so much, as I mentioned, that could transfer to basically everything else that they're going to do.
Yeah, I think that's awesome. I've heard the saying, you know, the more you know and experience, the less you actually use. And I think that's really true in testing, especially, you know, it's like the more you've been through, the more you can derive from one test, especially something as dynamic as the 40 with the different phases, you know, and, right. And you know, you can definitely, I'm sure you could, you know that someone who's great up to 20, it's super fast, probably can throw up some numbers in the weight room. You probably don't need to take him in the weight room, you know, to right. to necessarily, or at least know he would have the capability of doing that, you know,
exactly.
if that's something you went for.
Exactly.
You know, and those things. So I think that's a really insightful statement there.
And you know, you hit on it. I mean, having just simply the central nervous system or neuromuscular output to run fast is going to give you the materials to be strong in the weight room as well. I mean, obviously world-class sprinters and even some of our fastest guys, they may not be elite level performers in the weight room, but that's because their job isn't to be great in the weight room. If you took their nervous system and said, okay, now elite sprinter, I need you to be an elite weightlifter, you know, anthropometrically, they may not be suited to it, but I bet that they would put up decent numbers pretty fast, especially relative to their body weight. You know, I'm always astounded with some of our guys, in particular our fastest guy, you know, and again, when a guy's strong, I'm not screaming my head off to try to get him to move more weight, but our starting running back, who we haven't tested 40s, but he would be, I've seen enough 40s to know that he's definitely a legit 4.4 guy. You know, maybe he'll run faster than that one day at pro day or whatever. But, you know, he deadlifts over 500 pounds, and you'd think he was doing a clean pull, you know? And it's like, even though we're not, you know, force feeding these skill guys, you know, weight, still some of the outputs that they're capable of safely and easily, as I mentioned with my example of the Cal receiver, why are you putting 455 on his back? Well, I won't anymore, because when he did it, you know, it looked like he was going to jerk it. You know, the outputs that some of these guys are capable of, simply by just having a robust, you know, central nervous system is pretty amazing. And I even see it in my own training. You know, I mean, I'm old and slow now, but I still train for the 40 just because, you know, I need to be able to demonstrate stuff. I'm huge on that. If I can't demonstrate it, it's probably not going to be, you know, in the program. I want to demonstrate everything, and I want to be proficient at everything. So I train for the 40, you know, and being an older athlete, obviously I know my body can't serve more than one master, so I have to scale back my weight room work. But, you know, I'll come in, you know, after a great speed workout, I may come in and just deadlift, you know, and the other day I deadlifted, you know, 455 for 5 reps, which for me is great. And I'm not training, you know, I'm not training for that right now. But just the neural stimulus of having a speed day 3 times a week, for me, you know, I keep those strength qualities.
Yeah, it's amazing, I think, how strong you can be. You know, or like when you do a workout yourself and you go do a lot of speed and you feel that and you step in the weight room, you realize you don't have to do that much. You don't have to do an hour of lifting. You just have to do a few things, really. Yep. And I think that's the thing that a lot of people don't understand, especially like when you really train for speed, you know, pure lactic and pure, you know, pure speed work. Yeah, it's a great point. I love it. Can you talk a little bit about you mentioned a little bit before on how you kind of go through the yearly phases, you're training longer contacts early on, but can you expand just a little bit more on how you go through your periodization and planning from, when you see the guys after the season till the grind starts the next fall?
So we go short to long. I mean, and mainly because it mirrors what we like to do in the weight room. Again, our winter is typically our highest volume of work in the weight room. Everybody from line guys to skill guys. So knowing that heavy resistance work is going to transfer obviously to the start and to early acceleration, and knowing that after that they're not going to have a ton of gas in the tank to adapt to the speed work, it just makes sense to do to work short to long for us. It dovetails perfectly with everything that I'm trying to do. We don't have any hills here in Lubbock at all. Otherwise, I would love, that's when I would love to do hill work, because you can run a little bit further and it's completely safe. You're still working on those special strength qualities that they're going to need, and it kind of is a nice segue into speed. Later on when you get on flatland, I didn't have that luxury this year because we don't have any hills. So I did more sled work than I typically would. And I'm not that I'm against sleds. I just find that sleds are very difficult to monitor in order to get the exact stimulus that you want. Unless you're timing, and actually at Cal, I did try to time our sled work, but we didn't have a laser timing system, but it wasn't available to me at the time. So we were out there with our clipboards trying to chart guys as they sprinted with the sled so that I could, because I'm a believer in speed decrement. So I like to load it up as heavy as I can go without losing a specific percentage of speed. And depending on what we're working on, that will dictate what that percentage is. But let's say it's 10%. So you can put as much on there as you can and stay within that 10% window. And for some guys, that's going to be, well beyond the magic 10% body weight, and for some guys, it might be less than that, if they have poor relative strength. So if you think about it, loading everyone up with the same weight, if you did that in the weight room and said, all right, all guys that weigh 200 pounds, all put 275 on the bar. Some guys would be yawning as they were doing it because it was too easy, and some guys would be getting stapled to the platform, So it only makes sense to adjust it on the sled as well. Unfortunately, it's not extremely practical, especially when I've got, 40 guys out there. And I've got like 45 sleds, so everybody can have their own sled, but it's very difficult to one by one monitor the resistance. So we do go based off of body weight. When I'm early, early acceleration, we'll go. We have a fairly smooth, slidable turf field, so I'll use, roughly 30% body weight. And then as we get faster, I'll start to take weight off the sled, obviously. I'm not a fan of exclusively, and again, when I say I'm not a fan, I'm not saying that it doesn't work. I'm just saying for me, or guys, when we just take off running with a sled attached to us, biomechanically, it just doesn't look right to me. Like we just can't, it's not close enough to the technical model that I want to see. So I love to march with sleds, and we'll march with heavy sleds far, far beyond, 30% body weight. But we'll march, we'll bound, we'll march and then bound and then sprint, more drill oriented type stuff. So that I can kind of get the special strength qualities that I'm looking for, but it's also kind of not creating interference with the technical stuff that I'm trying to pair with it. So,
cool. I like it. So how, moving like more into the summer, how do your workouts kind of shift as you start to prepare for the season?
So now in the summer, because we know that we're going to be doing, especially second half of the summer, more energy system development type stuff. the summer, pretty much all of the movement skill volume is going to be higher, and the weight room volume will come down. We'll still be pretty high intensity in the weight room, but the sets and reps will be less, you know, and that will allow us to have, number one, more adaptive resources for them outside, but also, number two, enough time to really do it outside too, because if we're going to be, which we do, you know, the winter is primarily acceleration, start acceleration and up to transition, you know, really out to 20 yards. You know, we'll go beyond that a little bit. But the first block of the summer is really where we get out, you know, accelerating. And I'm talking about skill guys here for the linemen. Obviously, we'll do the same stuff, but just the distances may be shorter. Obviously, the sled weights will be different, so forth and so on. But when we get to the first block of the summer is really where we do a lot of our and second block to some extent. When we do the speed work, you know, obviously the longer the distances, they've got to have enough time to recover. So we can't be rushed outside. If we're out there rushing, I'll take, you know, we'll do less reps. I'd rather do three quality reps if I'm crunched on time, you know, than rush through six reps that are, you know, where guys are running 85% of their best time. I know I'm not getting a stimulus out of that. So, our speed work, I love flying 10s and 20s, mainly because it allows me to kind of focus on that piece of running that, as you mentioned earlier, a lot of times with football players can be challenging. It's not as instinctive as you would think it would be, you know, with them, but it allows me to focus on that one piece, the 10, the 20 yards, and not stress out over the acceleration piece, because it's going to be smooth and easy and we're really focusing on that speed zone, because obviously max speed is a function of how the acceleration went. You know, so if we're I find that when we're training and if we're running 40s or 50s or whatever, a lot of times guys don't get to work on their max speed because something went wrong early on. Right. So if a guy struggles, you know, if a guy has a technical malfunction early on, well, I'm not training the piece that I'm looking to train. So, and not to say that we don't sprint those longer distances, because we do, because obviously at some point you've got to put it all together. Right. But when I'm really focusing on that piece, the flying 10s and 20s are a huge asset to us, because it lets guys feel what it feels like. Because most of them have never gotten to that zone in a good position. They've already gone to crap by then. They're already, you know, butt kicking and leading with their chest, and it's the same. It's the same thing as like a wall drill or a harness drill for acceleration. It lets guys feel what it's like to actually run fast or be in the right position. And it gives you the context to say, okay, now you know what that felt like. Now when we put it all together, that's where you need to get to. So, but long-winded answer, but yeah, we work more of the longer distances, especially for the skill guys, in the summer.
Yeah, that sounds like you know, if you're going to teach an athlete to be relaxed, it seems like there's no better way than a fly 10, you know, because you try too hard on that, you're going slower. It's pretty much a set thing. I mean, it's probably a good testament too to, you know, being a multi-sport athlete, you know, in high school and doing running track and not just specializing early, because it seems like those players are probably more likely to be the grinders, you know, the guys that just can't like loosen up a little bit, you know, right, and run fast.
And you know, coming back around, that's where we were talking earlier, you know, that's where some of the mobility stuff really starts to rear its head, because if you've got a guy that has terrible thoracic mobility, you know, and is his traps are up to his ears, what do you think he's going to look like, you know, from 20 to 40? Do you think he's magically just going to, you know, loosen up? No, that's the guy that's going to be, you know, knocking people out with his fists as he, you know, finishes the race. So that's where, again, you've got to come all the way back to the beginning and be like, okay, if I give this guy some thoracic rotation, will that help him be able to relax other than just barking cues at him? Because sometimes the cues, you know, we all love our cues and we all think we're the greatest coaches, you know, but sometimes the cues can't fix it. You've got to figure out what can.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's a great point. And yeah, form's definitely dictated by function, you know, by the mobility, stability, the movement background. So great point. I love it. One more question for you, Scott. And I know you're speaking at the California State NSCA States Conference, and you said you were speaking a little bit on training speed with large groups. So just give us a quick little maybe snippet on you know what you're going to talk about, how you address that, and that'll be the last one here today.
So the big thing with large groups, obviously, is that you've got to find a way to coach them. So they've got to be in situations where it's manageable to give them coaching cues, knowing that if you've got, in my case, 100 athletes, that is probably not going to be during the actual sprinting itself, right? There's going to be so many of them, even if you break them into like rows of 10 or whatever, which is what I do. We'll run 8 speed groups or whatever, say, and speed group one, and we make it fun. You know, speed group one is kind of, it's like heats at a track meet. You know, speed group one is kind of illustrious. Like if you're in speed group one, you're a primo fast dude, you know, and they're competing to be the fastest guy in Texas, you know, and then it goes all the way down to speed group 8 and your interior alignment or whatever. So it's got, you know, say 10 to 12 guys per row, which is manageable, but it's still, you know, that's, it's still going to be difficult in that environment to get a ton of cues across. So you've got to prime them prior to that, by doing really stations. So we'll come out, we'll dynamic warm up, and then we'll break up into stations. It might be technique work, it might be special strength work, it might be a plyo, you know, like take a typical acceleration day. We'll come out, we'll warm up. Each coach is designated a specific position group or group of guys. Obviously, as I mentioned, I'm the skill guys, which is great because those are the guys that need to be able to run the best. And I follow them around from station to station. And of course I design the stations. One could be, say, you know, say it's January, you know, you could have one could be the wall drill, you know, and you're doing wall drill. And then one station could be broad jump technique. One station could be marching and skipping, you know, and then one station could be technique starts out of a 3-point stance if you're planning on testing the 40 or whatever, or it could be, you know, harness marching and something like that, you know, and all it does is give you, it kind of pieces together all the different components. It gives the athletes context for the sprints, you know, and the cues that you're going to be giving them. It gives them the special strength qualities that they're going to need to be able to run fast. And they get a little bit of skill transfer out of it too, you know, and we're coaching our butts off during that period, knowing that when we get to the actual speed work, because of the numbers, it's going to, and the hectic pace, because do the math, even though, you know, you're getting, you know, I'm trying to give these guys 1 minute for every 10 yards. But there's 8 groups. So by the time group 8 finishes, it's darn near time for group 1 to come back, right? So the time goes by fast, and you might pick out 2 or 3 guys, fire a cue at them, you know, but hopefully you've primed them with those stations so they know what to look for. And I video everything. I video everything because I know that I'm going to be able to bring a guy in and get quality coaching time with him in that context better than when we're out there. You know, there's just so much else going on. You know, I'll give him a cue and I'll move on because I got other guys to coach, but I'll bring them in, you know, and I video them so that I can give them quality feedback, you know, but guys like to come in. This is the carrot I dangle, you know, they like to come in because they want to see that photo finish. They want to see the video. who ran the fastest, you know, who won that race or whatever. So they want to see that. So I dangle that carrot, and then they come in to see, you know, who really won. And meanwhile, I get to coach them up on the technical component as well. So video is huge, you know, and I've used everything from the I usually have the video staff that films practice come out, and they'll video it, and then I can look at it in the same software that the coaches look at for sport practice. But there's plenty of apps on your phone and whatnot too, as well, that you can use to video guys and analyze guys. But when you're working with large groups, that's how I like to do it. You know, stations that'll last, you know, anywhere, I would say on average, like 6 minutes a piece. And that's mainly because obviously in NCAA, you only have so much time. You know, I would love to spend an hour and a half out there if I could, but then, you know, we wouldn't lift ever, you know, so it's again, warm up, prime them with the stations, get as much coaching in as you can. And those will progress, you know, those will progress, as the year goes on. We're working on different things. The plyos obviously will progress. And so later on in the summer, you know, maybe the stations are, step over drills, because now we're working on upright posture, and I'm trying to get the ankle over the knee, figure four, you know, introducing these guys to that figure four position is a game changer, because they all wonder why their hip flexors all lock up. And I'm like, well, because your lever is, you know, you've got a super long lever and you're taking a huge arc, you know, getting the ankle over the knee helps tremendously. Anyway, that's out on a tangent, but maybe you got step over drills. You've got your continuous hurdle hops, you know, maybe build-ups or a station, so forth and so on. So you can see that, you know, and then your power speed drills, your skipping and all that will progress. So you can see it kind of mirrors what you're doing with the speed work. And then the speed work volume is not going to be crazy again, because number one, I need maximal output. They've got to be able to run fast. So I can't have them do more sprints than they're prepared to run fast on. Once they can't run, you know, 95% plus of their speed, now I'm not getting what I want. So we'll literally, you know, it might be as low as 4 reps up to at the most 8 reps of, you know, whatever we're working on. It might be 20s, it might be 30s or whatever, which sounds like not much volume, but you got to remember everything else these guys are doing. You know, they are all lifting. They're all doing energy system development on top of it. You know, they're coming out and outside of us and doing position drills and 7-on-7 and stuff like that, you know. So it's all about what can I, you know, finding the minimum effective dose. What can I get everything I want out of by doing the least, you know. So that's what that large group session would look like, you know, more or less.
Cool. Yeah, I literally was just thinking minimum effective dose, like right before you said it. And it makes so much sense for building speed for football when they're doing, you know, so much else. That's such a great, smart mentality. I loved what you said too about, you know, the different groups of eight. You know, it's like there's the big dog group, and, you know, it's like you want to move up. You want to get in the big dog group. Go ahead.
Not to cut you off, sorry, yeah. But that's kind of the incentive too, is that – you can, if you're the fastest guy in your group, you'll move up, you know. So if you win all 8 races of group 2, guess what? You're in group 1, you know. And if you lose group 1, guess what? You move down. So it's these guys are competing to try to be, again, the fastest guy in Texas. And, you know, and I had a title belt made and stuff, and we had the Texas flag out there, and on our last, you know, our last day of spring, you know, winter/spring training, and when it was the, you know, it was the finals, it was like it was the Olympics or whatever, and the guy that won, he got the title belt, and he took the Texas flag, and he did a victory lap and stuff, you know, because you got to make it, you know, and you got to make it fun, but, you know, some people might shudder at that word, but, and it's a fine line, you know, because some guys think that clowning around is fun, you know, and that's obviously not it. But the more you can kind of make it fun for them and competing fun, you know, obviously it makes your job easier.
Absolutely. Yeah, you gotta have fun sometimes. I mean, it's, you know, maybe not in the frame of not clowning around, but if you had any fun, and you know, I've heard of track teams where there's even no talking allowed at practice, and I'm just like, man, how I feel like I'd lose it, you know. But no, that's awesome stuff. Great points. Cool. Well, I think that's about it for the podcast here. And man, lot of awesome stuff. I really learned a lot, Scott, and I know the listeners are going to too. A lot of stuff I'm going to take, you know, I mean, most of my strength and conditioning work is with aquatics these days, but working with club track, especially with just like the group stuff that you're talking about, you know, there's a lot that I think I can take into that realm and just have it be really effective. So thanks. You know, I definitely learned a lot. You know, best of luck to you and your players this summer and this upcoming season.
Thanks, Joel. Hopefully, you know, once you get everybody else on, hopefully I can come back around and get a round two on this thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Would love it.
Appreciate it, Joel. Thank you.
All right, you're welcome, Scott. Thanks.